is written. Hello and welcome to episode 141 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously lost in the desert and described as masterpieces. I am Nick, the white saviour of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
That's a name I haven't heard in a long, long time.
And we are discussing, if you haven't figured it out already, David Lean's epic, in the sense that it's very, very long, masterpiece, Lawrence of Arabia, from 1962, I think.
Yeah. I'm just remembering when Titanic came out, which is obviously 30 years later in a different climate, it was advertised in some markets as a 1 hour, 75 minute film because they thought people wouldn't put up with a 2 hour film. This is four.
This is 4 hours, or not just shy of 4 hours.
It has an intermission.
It's like a 10 minute intermission, isn't it? I thought maybe I'd accidentally opened up an extended version, but no, I think it's actually the version. It was restored, but not extended. I caught mine on Netflix, but I think it's the actual proper version. And this is the true. We're going to have to talk about true stories again, aren't we? but this is the potentially true story. Story of the wartime exploits, First World War exploits of starting as Captain T.E. Lawrence, subsequently made famous as Lawrence of Arabia. And it's based on his novel, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom.
Which is technically regarded as non-fiction, I think. But yeah, okay. The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, whether you regard it as explicitly fiction or not, is basically what he wanted you to know about what he did back in the day. Mm.
And also,
so
it's not
already 100% accurate. And then
he also lost it on a train, and because he'd already written it, he destroyed all his notes. So because it was already in his manuscript, so then he had to write it all from memory. So that may let some inaccuracies creep in as well.
There are various editions and revisions, and I think somebody's compiled the collected everything edition and so on. But anyway, so we start with that, which is not a completely reliable narrative. And then it is made into the film, which is, again, not even a completely reliable version of the book. So.
Yes, we've got an unreliable narrator of an unreliable narrator. Okay, we can get into the weeds a bit more of that. The kind of backdrop is true. There are some true things to it.
It is the dying days of the Ottoman Empire.
Yes.
It's also the Great War, but as far as the Ottomans are concerned, the dying days of the Empire is much more important.
Yes. So the antagonist here is the Ottoman Turks as they exist in what was then Arabia, the Middle East, sort of a conglomeration of Iraq and Iran and old Persia, I suppose, as it was before it became all the happy countries that all get along now, thanks to us, and pretty much what happened here, in fact.
Yeah, so David Lean is directing here, and I don't think we've had any of his films before at the moment.
I don't think so.
This got him his second Best Director Academy Award. First one was Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, yes, I've not seen that either. That is on my list of films that I should have watched but haven't. Perhaps we should do it for this.
I like it. There is that useful period of it is long enough after the war that people want to make war films, but at the same time it's soon enough after the war that we still have the people who were actually there and can tell people how it's actually done.
Right, yes.
And I think it makes for a very good crop of particularly 60s war films. But anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He was definitely known for epics. And I would assume the production company knew going in that we want an epic.
Yes. Lots of gorgeous shots of deserts and Shepherd's Hotel, or it looks like Shepherd's Hotel, but 20s Cairo. I should have watched this before I ran the Cairo section in Masks of Nyarlathotep, but never mind.
Although he hasn't yet done it at this point, he would go on to make Dr. Zhivago, which is So I think fair to say, similarly epic, though not on quite such a grand scale.
Haven't seen that either, though I'd love to. Presumably he met Omar Sharif here and decided to carry on with him in Dr. Zhivago.
I think they may have known each other earlier, but...
I have seen of his is Brief Encounter, yeah. Which I like but find frustrating in the same way I find Remains of the Day very frustrating.
Yeah. I think the thing I really noticed while watching this is how much it's not been copied exactly. I mean, we talked about that with Aliens, that everybody decided to do, they would have a, you know, military people versus Alien Greebly's film after that. But, for example, thinking back to The English Patient, which we watched some time ago.
That's the film that was like the most direct, oh, I really want to be that film, The English Patient.
But yeah, the visual grammar of the desert scenes there reminds me a lot of the ones here. That kind of thing.
Yes. I mean, it was a lot of famous directors, like Spielberg, I think, said it was what made him want to be a director. There's certainly plenty of other directors who, directors from like the 80s, 90s who saw this in the 60s and were like blown away by it as young people.
Yeah, because Spielberg and George Lucas are both getting their start in the late 60s, so.
Yes. So it did have a big influence, this film specifically, I think, on a later generation of filmmakers.
I can very easily picture some other producer saying, give me an epic like that about whatever the subject is. And you may recall the Monty Python sketch, Scott of the Antarctic.
Yes, I do, yes.
I think this may be one of the things that inspired that.
You will you'll have to link to that in the show notes. But... Yes, it's, I mean, visually, it's a stunner. I mean, I'm not going to argue. There's some scenes that, I actually watched, chunks of that. I didn't watch it all in one sitting, because, I don't know, somehow, modern life, you don't have 4 hours free at a time quite often. But if I did, I probably wouldn't spend them watching
the rest of it. I think it was four chunks for me in the end.
Yeah, similar for me. The intermission was a good breaking off point. But the assault on Aquaba, it's interesting because it's a war film that doesn't have a great deal of combat in it, but still is epic. And where it does have combat, it quite often, not always, but quite often, we get a kind of a much further back view. We're not up in there visceral watching the hacking and the chopping and the screaming and the maiming. We're right back. And the thing I'm thinking of particularly is the siege of, or the assault on Aquabar, where, perhaps we should go through it more sequentially, but I wanted to mention this while it's in my mind. There's a scene, Aquabar is, got huge guns, pointed at the sea, but they are gun emplacements. They're not things that can be turned round. And so they cross the desert to approach it from the land.
Because everybody knows that this desert is impossible to cross.
Yes, and then they...
I don't seem to have any great trouble over it, but, yeah, shrug.
Well, yeah. Well, we can talk about that at least forever, going over there. But there's a scene where the camels are riding into Aqaba, and it's just one long panning shot, sort of starting on the outskirts, and then we watch the camels ride all the way through Aqaba to the sea. And the panning shot stops on a gun emplacement, unmanned and pointless, just looking out at the empty sea. I was absolutely blown away by it. It was a spectacular bit of filmmaking, I thought. So cinematographically, oh dear.
There are just lots of beautiful shots of desert light and sand and people walking across it and so on.
Yes, we have the famous arrival of Omar Sharif when Lawrence and his Bedouin guide are waiting at an oasis. Well, they've drunk at an oasis that is the wrong oasis to drink from because these tribes are at war. And then we have this kind of blurry, dark figure that we just slowly watch arrive. It's visually stunning. I was blown away. Peter O'Toole Goodness me.
My God, was he ever that young.
Yes, he's so, you don't think of him as like a, I mean, he's like a picture of Aryan perfection. I know that, but he, you know, he's, high cheekbones, slim, blonde,
I can picture an also very dodgy fanfic about this man.
Yes, yes. Well, it's
which,
quite
to be
a,
fair, he would probably love. So.
Yes, yes. It's quite a homoerotic film, I think it's fair to say. Are there any women in it?
Dudley, there are one or two in the background. I think I would regard it as primarily homosocial. I mean, there isn't necessarily any screwing going on or indeed being contemplated, but...
No.
The friends you make as a man are also men. The people you deal with are all men, and that's just the world you live in. And
yes, and I suppose this is
where you get the kind of pulp hero who is completely nonplussed by women. It's not just the classic shyness thing. It's I simply don't know how women work because I meet very few of them.
I don't know why H.P. Lovecraft sprung to mind. He's not an action hero by any means. Yeah, I do feel it was, personally, I feel it was a bit, maybe I'm reading too much into it. There were a lot of kind of longing looks, I feel, from Omar Sharif's character, at least. Here's the thing.
That part was originally offered to a different person, whom we've actually seen in Ribbon of Memes before. Horst Buchholz.
Horst Buchholz.
Whom we saw in The Magnificent Seven.
Oh, wow, okay.
That noticeably non-Egyptian or Arabic-looking guy.
Yes, I was going to say, I mean...
And the only reason he turned it down, he'd signed up for something else.
I'm sure he would have been good in it. He was a good, angsty actor. I'm very glad it was Omar Sharif instead, though, I must say.
And there is no shortage of people who look vaguely Middle Eastern, even in Hollywood in the 60s. So...
Well, you would think there were, though, because we have several blacked-out white people in this film, which we can... Well, we can talk about the politics of it. I mean, as far as the plot goes, do you want to go through the plot? It's a long plot, but I suppose we could summarise it.
Super summarise. Okay, so, part one.
Yes.
It is the First World War. It is the war in the desert. This whole thing is flashback, but...
It starts with Lawrence finding out why you shouldn't go very fast around a corner on a motorbike sometimes.
Particularly without a helmet, not that it would have helped in this particular situation. So, basically, Lawrence is a young misfit lieutenant who, as usually depicted in film, if he said half of that stuff, he would be out of the army and in a prison cell. But he is the guy who has no respect for authority and always does his own thing.
Yes, he has some very tolerant
maverick.
CEOs.
That's the term I'm looking for.
Yes, he's a maverick.
But without
an obvious cause, he's a bit of a rebel without a cause.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, he seems to like being in the desert and just being in this country, the people and so on, but he. Never quite seems. I think a lot of this is he's never quite satisfied.
Yes.
He's clearly excited by danger and seeking it out to some extent, but at the same time he's comes to hate what that actually means, the fighting and the carnage and so on. So yeah.
Yes.
This is even portraying him as a hero. This is not a well-adjusted person. But anyway, he gets sent by a fictionalised version of, well, the civil service, in effect.
We have Claude Rains cropping up in one of his last film roles. He doesn't look well. I was distracted because I was feeling sad because he doesn't look very well.
Though, to be fair, he also doesn't look like any other Claude Rains part. He's very good at that.
Oh, yeah.
You can recognise him if you're looking, but you... At least I don't instantly look at the guy and think, oh, wow, that's Claude Rains.
Yeah, unrecognisable in The Invisible Man. Sorry.
But anyway, he is sent out to...
Love a bit of Claude Rains, though.
...see what is happening with Prince Faisal, the future King of Iraq, but we don't know that.
Yes.
Who is leading a revolt of essentially his tribe against the Turks.
Yes. Who is played by Alec Guinness, famous Middle Eastern man, Alec Guinness.
Olivia was offered this one but dropped out.
I think Alec Guinness is very proud of his accent. To me, that is a foreign, generic foreign accent.
The impression I got was that he was doing it the way he thought Olivia would have done it.
Yeah.
But okay. The other thing, I found it very difficult not to think of Star Wars because it's very much the same voice and body style as Ben Kenobi. So.
Yes, in the same, you know, he's basically on Tatooine as well, so it's tricky. I found myself slightly annoyed by Alec Guinness. Not that he was bad here, just that I know famously he hated doing Star Wars and felt it was silly. But he's fine, like, blacking up and doing this. I found myself a little irritated.
If I watch Star Wars again, I will definitely be thinking of him as ripping off his role here, because he really is.
He's anyway.
Yeah, anyway, so
cultural appropriation is fine.
Go and find this guy and, don't do any of your Maverick tricks. We know your sort.
Surprise, you'll never guess what he does when he gets
but
there.
But anyway, yeah, he is sent off with the Bedouin Guard, Sherif Ali, Omar Sharif,
kills Well, he's sent off with a different, but, oh yes, Omar Sharif
kills him.
Kills
drinking
him,
yeah. From the wrong well, and so on. He meets the Colonel Brighton, is effectively the British staff liaison too.
Now this is one of the Antonys, the Antony Qs that I get mixed up. This is Antony Quinn,
no,
not Antony Quayle. Oh, bother. This is Antony Quayle, who I like very much here as well.
Yeah. Who clearly does not want to be in this war, does not want to be in this country. Just shut up and keep quiet and maybe we can all go home sometime soon.
He's got that, I find it admirable, maybe that's the British Empire in me, but that kind of... Yeah, not at all interested, but doing his duty, kind of long-suffering thing
basically
going on.
Everybody knows perfectly well that this revolt is not going to succeed. Yeah, they can be a thorn in the side of the Turks. They can distract some of the military attention, but that's really all that anybody expects. So Lawrence, of course, breaks the rules. Sorry, I may be a bit fed up with the whole Maverick rule breaker.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's perhaps a bit unfair on Lawrence of Arabia, though this wasn't the first time we had
Yes, I mean, it wasn't anything like as much of a cliche at this point. And so basically says, Colonel Brighton is saying, right, well, you guys have got very wiped out, you're losing men, deserting every day, you need to retreat. Lawrence says, why don't we cross this completely uncrossable desert and attack the port city? And then the British reinforcements can come in once we've taken control of the guns.
Yes, his plan is to take 50 men across and then presumably all the Bedouin or other Arabs on the other side will be so impressed that 50 men cross the desert, they'll all join in.
Also that the fortification is not designed to withstand an assault from land.
And do you know what? It works.
Yeah, and so it goes off with Sherif Ali, who is a little ray of sunshine. You're going to die. Oh, well.
Remember, you are mortal. That's basically his job for the whole film.
Yeah. During that crossing, one guy falls off his camel, and they notice in the morning that he isn't there anymore, and so Lawrence goes back to rescue him. We've got this desert is regarded as uncrossable because you can, yeah, it is just about possible if you fill up your water skins to bursting at the last well and then go really carefully by night, rest during the day, all the rest of it. You can just about cross it. So he gets to the other end where there is no water yet and instantly goes back to find this guy.
Yes, he's not refilled his camel or anything.
And so, somehow he finds him in this trackless desert.
But it's all to set up this very... I was rolling my eyes at this, but then I did appreciate the kind of... It sets up this dramatic thing that
unite
the tribes. Yes, okay.
Recounting the plot first.
Yes.
So he comes back with Ghassim and the men love him.
This is where the sort of legend of Lawrence of Arabia starts, I guess.
They need to recruit from the tribe that's in the, basically near Aqaba, the Hawitat. And here we have an Anthony Q. This is an Anthony Quinn.
Yes.
As Alda.
I like Anthony Quinn. He's really not just blacked up, he's kind of Faginned up. It's very, he's got this hook nose. Maybe historically accurate, apparently it was, but it's very distracting, I find.
Yeah, I mean, his career, he's in that transition from, I have been a leading man, but I'm not quite as pretty as I used to be, so I'm shifting to character actor. I mean, the year before this, he'd been Andrea, the resistance fighter in The Guns of Navarone.
Oh, yes.
The thing that would really, probably his biggest hit was a couple of years after this in Zorba the Greek, but...
That's what I knew him for before I knew films very much.
But, so Lawrence persuades him that, you want to join this, and there will be lots of loot and money and stuff.
He's quite a mercenary, his old Anthony Quinn.
But here we get the second half of the Ghassim story, as you were saying.
Yes, in order to unite the tribes, there is a murder and blood cries out for blood. But if one of the new tribe, I'm afraid I forget the Bedouin names, but if one of the new tribe
the thing is, basically, it turns out somebody in the group that Lawrence has brought has killed somebody of the Hawitat.
And he must be killed.
The Hawitat say, well, we do the thing we do, which is we kill the murderer. And the Bedouins say, well, yeah, if you kill our guy, we're going to be at feud and no assault on Aqaba. So Lawrence says, well, right, I'm not a Bedouin, I'm not a Hawitat, I'll kill him.
He checks first, he's like, all right, if I do this, that'll be all right, we're still on. And everyone's like, oh yeah, seems all right. Yeah, which seems a bit, it's very much the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law. But they very quickly give up this man's life. But it's really...
Does it count as Orientalism when it's Arabs? It's that same exotic...
There's
the
a
culture
lot
that
of,
is not like ours, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of this... Yeah.
Exoticism. Anyway.
And also, and Lawrence's reaction to it, which is, I mean, the film is perhaps more nuanced. Well, I'd like to talk about Lawrence's characterization when we've done the plot summary. But anyway, Lawrence, has to kill, Ghassim.
And then it turns out after he's come up with this brilliant plan that, oh crap, this is the guy I actually rescued.
Yes, and it's a nice bit because he has set up the fact, you know, as I said in the opening, nothing is written, I can change anything, but it turns out he didn't change that. But they then go on and assault Aqaba.
Yeah, and take it with, you know, some casualties, but essentially not too much opposition. Oh, he's picked up a couple of orphan kids as well.
Yes, not as big a part as I was expecting for these two.
So then, the Bedouin and Hawitat are investing Aqaba.
Disappointed there is not as much money as they thought there would be, or it's all in paper, which is no good to these exotic.
And Lawrence says, "That's
Arabs.
All right. I'll get the British to bring lots of money for you. I'm just off over this way."
yeah, he can't resist going over these uncrossable deserts. So then he's off across the Sinai.
Yep, this one's the Sinai, and one of the orphans falls into quicksand and dies.
Is that how quicksand works?
No.
No, I didn't think so.
I mean, there are sinkhole-y things, but generally you can stay afloat in it, because it's denser than a body. But anyway, this is a thing that has been a topic of discussion. You know, things that my childhood in the 1970s taught me would be a huge problem that turned out not to be. Quicksand. Martin Bormann.
yes.
But anyway.
Okay, so he does cross the Sinai.
So he's down to one orphan at this point and gets back to... Cairo.
Back to Cairo. I think the guy, the motorcyclist who he hails on the other side of the bridge, is either played by David Lean or voiced by David Lean.
Hey.
A little bit of trivia. Anyway, there we go. End of. Oh, it's not quite end of part one.
So he makes sure his Arab follower gets served in the hotel, and then he turns in his report.
Yes, that's a nice bit, actually, horribly racist British people. And Lawrence, already caught between two worlds now, he doesn't really fit in either one of them.
Yeah, but also, at the same time, Farage is saying, look, well, at least as I see it, with perhaps a more modern viewpoint, Farage is trying to get him not to do this, and I'll go outside with the other guys. And I see this to some extent as, look, you have a certain amount of credit that you can use to get stuff done. And you're blowing it on getting me served lemonade.
Yeah.
Whereas you could be blowing it on getting your next war plan approved. All right, as it turns out, he has enough for both. But anyway.
But also, in a place where Farage will be incredibly uncomfortable, no one's happy there. He's not doing it for Farage, I don't think. He's doing it for his own aggrandizement.
Yeah. But anyway, he reports into General Allenby.
It's played by Jack Hawkins, I think. With a shaved head, because he was less bald than General Allenby.
He gets another promotion, and is right told, okay, you can have lots of arms and lots of money, no problem. No artillery, though, because we're using that. Are there any plans for what's going to happen in Arabia after the war? Oh, no, says Allenby. No plans at all.
Nothing at all. We'll give it back to the Arabs.
Which is, I mean, yes, he's obviously lying, but also this is where the film makes Lawrence out as an innocent, because I don't think there was anyone in the British Army who would have expected them to be giving it back to the Arabs. Yeah. Here is a place that the Ottomans had clearly regarded as a valuable colonial outpost. It is going to be somebody's colony, therefore.
I think in the context of the film, historically, I totally agree. In the context of the film, as T.E. Lawrence is portrayed, I think you could argue he's kind of slightly naive and otherworldly, and
yeah,
I believe it within the film. Yes, yeah. So it works for me within the film. Yeah. I absolutely agree. Historically, that's pretty.
But anyway. Yeah, and while watching this, I think it was about this point that I read that Brando had turned down the part of Lawrence.
Marlon Brando?
Yeah.
Wow.
This is about his Mutiny of the Bounty era, so.
I mean, I'm sure he could have done it, but there is something magnetic about Peter O'Toole here. It's incredibly watchable.
Another thing that I wrote down during this is, where is your hat, man? You know, here you are, you're going across the desert.
I have to admit, there's a reason they wear those hats, okay.
Anyway, that gets us to the intermission.
Yes, now we're halfway through. 10 minutes later, when you've been to the toilet, bought your ice cream, we're back. And it's, I don't know, several months later.
Yeah, so basically Lawrence is the guerrilla leader, blowing up railways and things of that sort.
Yes, we have an American correspondent determined to find a kind of hero to help bring America into the war. I'm pretty sure they were already in the war at this point.
Well, it's a question of when, perhaps.
Yeah, okay. So he finds out about Captain Lawrence and creates Lawrence of Arabia, I guess. Though that's... It's not...
We don't actually see much of that because our viewpoint is mostly with Lawrence.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought that would be the theme of the second half because it starts with the reporter, but... As you say, he crops up every so often and kind of tuts at Lawrence, but he doesn't do very much otherwise.
Meanwhile, we get a practical lesson in explosive safety.
Yes, don't run around with a detonator in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence loses his second orphan because of that.
Has to shoot him himself because this is a hit-and-run raid. We ain't going to be here. The Turks aren't going to be here, etc.
Yes, then having made a ton of money, his whole army kind of deserts him, really. Not in a we-hate-you way, just like, well...
We've got enough money now, thanks.
Bye.
Lawrence goes scouting, is it Daraa?
Daraa.
And when everybody, including Ali, says, you don't look even slightly like one of us, mate. You're going to stick out like a sand-inflamed thumb. he then, no, it'll be fine, and is promptly caught.
Promptly caught and unspecifiedly, but probably sexually abused. I think even in his novel he was a bit vague about what actually happened to him, but it seemed to be a turning point for him.
So he is shaken. He does not believe in himself anymore. General Allenby basically says, "Poor baby, get back on the front, you wimp."
I mean, it doesn't take much. It basically, like, pull yourself together, man. And Lawrence is like, "Yep, all right, I will." And that's it. That's the end of his existential crisis.
But he's then getting irregular forces together to support the big push on Damascus. Which again, he does largely by promising them money that he has no way of providing.
Yes, they never seem too annoyed about that.
They attack a retreating Turkish column and
butcher it, basically.
Yeah, one of the men from there was a city that they
Talas or something.
Tafas. And so one of the guys who was from that place that had been destroyed says, "No prisoners." And Lawrence tries to stop him, and the guy charges off and gets shot down on his own. And at that point, Lawrence reckons, okay, well, I need to have a charge at this point, and the only way they're going to charge is if I say no prisoners too, so I do. And then he hits himself for it.
Gets into it, it's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one bit of
this war... This is where the reporter finds him pretty much dripping with blood. It's time to stop now.
This is the one bit of war that we actually kind of see the grit and the blood and the dirt.
Mm.
Not massively graphically, but for this film, it's quite graphic, I guess.
So they take Damascus before the British arrive, which obviously the British thought was impossible. They set up a council to administer the city, but fall apart arguing because they are basically still thinking in terms of tribes.
Because they're Arabs and they couldn't possibly understand how to administrate a city.
And the British are moderately careful and say, well, yes, of course we'll lend you some technicians to run the power plant, but obviously the power plant will have to be under British administration if we do that.
Yes. true to pretty much anything the British do from 1800 onwards, I think.
Yeah, but it's certainly portrayed as we are taking slight advantage of this self-destructive situation, and if we don't, then the city is going to burn, as opposed to any other viewing of it.
Now, Allenby's family were horrified by this, because it's sort of implied, or they felt, I'm not sure it comes across that way so much in the world, but they felt the film portrayed him as just sitting back and letting the city burn so we could then take advantage of it. I didn't really feel that's quite how the film puts it across, personally.
Yeah, I mean, the generic British attitude, i.e. of basically everybody except Lawrence, is, well, these guys don't really count. We will happily have 10,000 of them slaughtered to save one British life, etc.
Yes.
And now, at some point, to some extent, that was quite valid anyway, so...
At some point during that, I can't remember when Lawrence, the Sykes-Picot agreement is mentioned. I think he knows about it with Damascus, though, but this is the agreement. Basically made up by a French and a British civil servant to carve up the Middle East after the war.
On the basis that the Ottoman Empire was not going to be in a position to contend anymore.
Yeah, it's extraordinary that they just sort of came up with it and enacted it without really any consultation with the public or anything like that. But there we are. That didn't lead to any troubles later on. but I can't remember when Lawrence, in the film at least, becomes aware of it. But I think he is aware of it in Damascus.
So, certainly the way the film tries to show it is he is completely surprised by this and feels betrayed.
Yes, and
it's not clear where this started, but certainly by this point he is trying to promote the idea of an Arabia for the Arabs. You know, let us have this country run by the people who actually live here.
Now, again, as portrayed, I feel like his annoyance is more, you've made me look like a liar, rather than you've betrayed all these noble people.
I don't know. I think the film's trying for both. How well it succeeds is another matter. But, I'm going to use a very cliched phrase here. This is a film of its time.
Yes.
If you made it now, I suspect you would make it from the Arab viewpoint, and you would show them this idiot who is clearly some sort of holy fool and a charismatic leader, but also just makes lots of mistakes.
Yeah. I mean, that's the plot. The film basically ends at Damascus, and then Lawrence disillusioned with it all.
He is depressed again on a different level, and sets off home, and his jeep taking him to, where would it be, Alex, I guess, but anywhere, where the port that he's going to sail for home from.
And for you, Lawrence, the war is over.
He's overtaken by an ominous motorcycle.
So... I mean, my first reaction to watching the first half was, this is White Savior the movie, isn't it?
Mm.
And it is more nuanced than that, but there's
a lot of that
overtones.
In there, certainly.
The Arabs, basically, he is the catalyst for everything. The Arabic people cannot do anything without him, really. They don't believe that they could, and when they try, they fail, and he is the one who, for good or ill, gets them doing the things.
Hmm. He is the traditional man on the horse who says, follow me.
Now, it undercuts it a bit. You know, in Damascus, he is trying to bring them together, but he can't. But even then, it feels like even this heroic white savior can't bring these disparate people together because they're too exotic and he doesn't quite understand them still. He's still British.
Or possibly, given that we know that Prince Faisal is going to go on to be the actual ruler, I got also a sensation of, yes, but you can't snap your fingers and make it happen now. This is going to take actual prolonged months and years of political work, and that is not Lawrence. So,
yes, it's nice that we see the kind of more pragmatic, canny diplomats like Alec Guinness and like Claude Rains actually start to lay the groundwork of what's actually going to happen. Now Lawrence has had his fun. And it's a nuanced look at Lawrence. You know, he's an interesting character. I no idea how true it is to life, which we'll talk about in a minute. But as an action hero, aside from the White Savior stuff, aside from the of its timiness of the film, which are hard to ignore, he is an interesting character because he's given a number of deep psychological flaws. You know, he is, he's clearly trying to go native, but much as he likes the exoticism of it, he wants to be the hero. He doesn't want to blend in and become part of their culture. He wants to be the hero of the culture. He's a real messianic figure, or wants to be.
Yeah, and it was during watching part two of this in particular, where he's doing that I suddenly realised, this came out in 1962. Dune came out in 1965. And it seems to me that Dune is very much about what happens when the external messiah gets what he wants. And Herbert is saying, yes, but if he does get what he wants, it's going to go horribly wrong anyway.
We were talking about what was influenced by Dune. Absolutely.
But it very much struck me.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about Paul Atreides in that context. But yeah, they're similar characters.
But also, you know, we're talking about his depression after the after his capture and so on. And I think there's a certain amount of... There is the Lawrence who is the smiling devil-may-care guy on the horse, and there is the Lawrence who actually exists, and he has to climb into the guy on the horse suit again.
Yes.
For the next big thing.
Yeah, and it's a really well done put. I think Peter O'Toole's fabulous. You know, he does get across this kind of weird mix of absolute extrovert, but also shy, introverted character that finds this horrifying bloodlust within him from time to time as well. I think it's a really interesting thing to think of that
as part of who he is, but it is.
But and ends up, by ending up kind of despising himself, just wants to forget about everything that he's done and just get away from it all. It's an intro. It doesn't end on a high. There's no kind of romantic subplot, unless you count Omar Sharif. There's no kind of glory, and it's an interesting, he sort of is on a high at the end of part one, and then progressively gets more depressed and more disillusioned and more sad. And it goes back to Damascus, but it's not quite the same. I thought it was a very interesting portrayal. Whether, you know, the one white guy, and, you know, in the film, he is basically portrayed as, I am the one British person in Arabia that did all this stuff. And that, again, historically, I don't think that's...
But, I mean, he's also the one British person who has any sort of individuality of thought, so...
Yes, but I agree. I think nowadays we would not be obsessed with this one character in the same way, or we would want to see it, yeah, from the native perspective.
And even as it is, I think the film version is very much simplified from the really quite complicated bloke who wrote the book.
Have you read Seven Pillars of Wisdom?
Some many years ago, but yeah.
I haven't. I've read bits of it.
But, I mean, it's a film, and to some extent it's inevitable that you have to show straightforward people doing straightforward things in film, because subtlety is hard and you start losing the audience.
Yeah, I think filmically it...
I think if he had actually been that simple, he probably couldn't have done the stuff he did.
Well, I think, as we've said before, you know, one or two-dimensional characters are typically good enough for a film. As a character study... which I suppose it is, as well as an epic. He does get he is more nuanced, you know, he's a more interesting character than, your standard action hero grunt. His motives are, they're there, but they're muddy, and you can't quite, he's not an open book, I think, on the screen. You can see there's layers to him. Yeah. And I appreciate the film for doing that. I think that's a good, interesting performance. He's kind of the only character, the only native characters we get are really one-dimensional, I think. You know, Alec Guinness's character, King as he would be then, Faisal.
Ali comes closest, but even he is basically, his job is to say, Lawrence, you're going to die.
Yes, yeah. No one else. I mean, it is a study of Lawrence, but, but as a film, I want to just take it out of historical context for a minute. As a film, does it work
way.
For you?
That is the best way to watch it. I'm not an expert in this period, but I know a bit about it. And as a representation of the period, it's a bit rubbish. But as an epic film, trying to remember not to remember that these are actual people and actual cultures and so on, it's great.
Yeah,
it does the job of being an epic film.
I find it so distracting that it is rooted in reality, which is maybe why, in theory, I prefer Dune. Though I don't have a ton of love for Dune. I haven't seen the new version, so I should probably give that a try. I have read the book twice now, trying to think, what is it that everyone loves about this?
I don't love it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's okay, but I don't find it incredibly inspirational. Yeah, I think as a film, as an epic, it's an interesting one. It's an interesting character. It's a really interesting period. Visually, it's stunning. I do think there is a load to enjoy here. There's a lot.
Also, a film from the day when extras were cheap.
Yeah.
The only vaguely modern film I've seen with anything like that level of crowd scenes was Red Cliff, where they could simply borrow a couple of regiments of the Chinese army. So.
Yes. If you weren't in China nowadays, you would just CGI a lot of these films. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid I'm shallow enough. Even if I saw that, you know, that scene of Aquaba that I was expanding was fantastic. If that looked visually identical, but I knew it was CGI, it would lessen it for me. Mm. That's my problem.
There was one thing that threw me slightly. I mean, it was one of those things that once I'd noticed, I found it hard not to notice. Generally, with the long shots of crossing the desert, you can see all the sand being kicked up behind them, and yeah, there is this dust cloud falling. But in the close-up shots, even when we're looking back along the column, we don't, because obviously those guys have just been posed there for that shot.
Yes, there's a few where they do go through a dust cloud,
and sometimes they intercut a bit, and it's very obvious that it's flipping in and out, which is a shame. But otherwise, it visually it works really well.
Yeah. As a story,
and the rhythm
does it work?
I think
it's
pretty good too.
Yes, yeah.
Not a brilliant story, but yeah, it has the highs and lows and the action and the contemplative and so on. And this works well.
Yeah, I don't love the film in the sense that I wasn't that invested with Lawrence and I wasn't that emotionally moved by the film. But as an action story, as a drama, as a historical epic, which I guess what it is, it's better than the English Patient. But that does a job of trying to, it's got that weird framing story, The English Patient, which I found distracting. As a film out of context, it's very, very good. I go short of saying brilliant because I just personally, didn't massively enjoy it. It just wasn't kind of into it, I suppose, and that's just a subjective thing. Well, I can see it was brilliant.
I think part of it is that this isn't a style of film that exists anymore.
Mm.
I mean, you can have your great big superhero CGI fest, but it is always very much the little personal story that is being told against the background of huge fights.
Yes.
And this is trying to tie it into the bigger story of the development of Arabia as a national identity. Maybe it doesn't do it very well, but it tries.
Well, that comes on to the thing that unfortunately does distract me tons is whenever I'm watching something like this, I just have an urge to think, yeah, but did he actually do that? So when he crossed the desert right at the opener, when they crossed the desert to Aqaba, I'm like, okay, let's just see how accurate this film is. I'm just going to check. Did he do it? No, he didn't. No, he said, should we go across this desert? And all the Arabs went, are you fucking nuts? No, we're not going to do that. We'll go around the top. And that kind of set the tone for me that I just, once I'd lost any belief in its historical accuracy, it lessened the film a lot for me. I should be able to take these things out of context, but much, when it's a biopic, it matters to me whether it's accurate. It really does, I'm afraid.
I think this may be a thing we've talked about before, that if you're saying, here is this actual historical person, then I hold that to a higher standard of accuracy. That, well, for example, who is the actor? Anthony? I'm thinking of the Claude Rains role, Mr. Dryden, who is basically a composite of Mark Sykes, as in Sykes Picot, and Ronald Storrs, and David Hogarth, and Henry McMartin, and various other people. But to make it work in the film, he is just this one guy.
Well, I don't mind that, Samar.
Yeah, that's the sort of simplification that I just had to put up with in film. But
yes,
but Jackson Bentley, he's based largely on Lowell Thomas, but Lowell Thomas was a young man who spent a few weeks in the field with Lawrence and then wrote about what a great hero he was, as opposed to this middle-aged man who's just hanging around long-term.
Yeah, right, yes. Also, you know, the film gives you the impression Lawrence is the only one doing any of this stuff at all, and that's not true. There were other British operatives in the area, less media whorish, I suppose. And I can't quite get over the white saviour aspect of it. Mm. So they all lessen the film for me, because there's a lot of inaccuracy. As we say, this is a film that is, you know, designed to be an epic, to tell a particular narrative based on one man's perspective, one man who was very good at portraying himself as he wanted to. Mm. A complex, interesting man, for sure, but with his own agenda, writing The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And then having a book based on it, having a film based on it.
Yeah, this is not a history. It's not trying to be a history. It has characteristics that might fool you into thinking it was trying to be a history. Just ignore those, I think, it would be fair to say.
I think that's the spirit you have to watch the film in. But I have to acknowledge that it lessens it for me.
Hmm. You are in the end saying these things about real people and real cultures.
Yeah, and that bothers me if it's not true, because this will be what's remembered.
Yeah.
I know history is all, you know, opinion and what is true and all that, but you don't have to flat out lie, do you? So, anything else to say about Larry in the Sand?
Well, I certainly got a feeling that, the man who would be king copied that shot.
Yes.
Star Wars, obviously. I mean, even bits of High Road to China, the whole, we are in the tents of the desert nomads.
Yeah, there's a ton of, I mean, hugely influential.
I'm sure this didn't start some of those things. I mean, remembering the Sheikh back in the day, but, and Valentino. But,
yes. It's not.
I think this updated the cliche for a generation of what this stuff was supposed to look like.
Yeah, I think we've talked before about, you know, this sets the template of, you know, this is an American high school. This sets the template of, this is a historical epic. This is what you do. And if you veer from that, then you've got to have a reason for veering from it. If not, stick with this. And I think that is a sign of a film that succeeded on many levels.
Yeah, and again, just difficult to regard from a modern perspective, because this isn't a film that fits into a modern perspective.
Yes.
So
I'm happy to try and take it in the context of the time and as it was, and as for I'd be hard-pressed not to call it a masterpiece, to be honest.
I think the level of influence alone would make it that, and we've just been talking about the problems, but overall it works. It is a good film to watch, even if it is perhaps a bit of a slog to a modern viewer.
It's not one of my masterpieces that I would watch and then think, you know, I'll watch that again, or I could watch that again, or I could watch that tomorrow.
Am I still watching it? I'm not sure.
I can tell if I'm checking the time when I'm watching a film, then I'm not truly engaged. But yes, a masterpiece with reservations for me. Well, it's time to leave this episode in the desert, I think.
There's probably something about pouring out water on the sand or something, but I was drinking heavily last night, so I'm pouring out water onto me.
Good day, everybody.